So tonight we have Rob again. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Jill. All right. And good evening again, everybody. My name is Rob Sipple. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Moves from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, surely by the grace of a loving God, the power that I found is the result of the program in our textbook, Alcoholics Anonymous, by the awakened members of the Sacred Fellowship who led me to and through this program and continue to guide me today, and by the service that God leads me to and that I'm allowed and encouraged to participate in, and by a host of teachers in my life, I've been moved from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body to that state that I experienced today as recovered, free, able to consistently see the truth and to walk freely and with a bit of dignity into life, not running from or hiding from anything anymore. And again, thank you for your kind invitation and welcoming me back. And as we talked about last week, or where I spoke about how we would proceed over the next several weeks, is to go through this book in the way that the early members described how they went through it with newcomers, and how I currently try to go through it as close to that as possible with newcomers. And in qualifying them rapidly and quickly, in taking them to allow them to see their truth, to share my experience and to help them identify their truth of what they experienced when they were out there on the run and in their cups, and to move them to a place where they can perhaps see the need. You know, not only do they lack power, but do they need to, you know, seek power, and show them how I began to find that power through the actions that I took as the result of this practical program of spiritual action. And then very simply ask them, are they interested in doing it? Are you in, or are you out? And if they're in, then on the second visit, we start writing inventory. You know, the short version of that is, if you've stopped throwing up, you should have a pen and paper in your hand and be moving toward writing inventory. In working with others, it talks about on page... Oh, there we go. It talks about how their attention, whether regardless of how I end up getting, whether it's through a association with a treatment program or with a doctor or from family members or even in a meeting, that I should be introduced to them as one who has recovered. And is that my experience? What is my great fact today? Is my great fact that I've had a deep and effective spiritual experience that's revolutionized my whole attitude toward life, toward God, and toward my fellows, and toward the universe? And if so, am I deepening and broadening that on a daily basis? And if so, am I showing up and being useful? And particularly within this fellowship, in showing someone else how to show someone else. And it talks about, you know, keeping things on a very basic level, keeping it very simple. On the bottom of page 92, I'm able to talk to them about the hopelessness of alcoholism because I offer a solution. What is the solution that I offer? Is the solution that I offer, well, just don't drink today and go to a meeting, and then go to another meeting tonight, and then go to another meeting tomorrow? Or do I have a solution that's based in our spiritual program, or our practical program of action, our spiritual principles, I should say? And then on top of 93, it tells me to stress the spiritual feature of freedom. All of this, remember, is what we're talking about on the very first visit. A couple weeks ago, actually. And this doesn't happen that often, but again, I was at a meeting and a gentleman walked in and he identified himself as saying that this was his very first AA meeting. He'd never been to an AA meeting of any sort. He actually looked it up on the website and he showed up a couple minutes late and You know, so I approached him afterwards with a book in hand and asked him a very simple question. I said, you know, do you want to get better for good and for all? Do you want to stop drinking? And he said, yes. And at the same time, other people in the group, you know, there was one guy who I know has been around that group for a long time, walked up, patted him on the back and said, well, good luck. And a bunch of people came up and said, hey, do you want my phone number? And, you know, another guy said, I can get you more phone numbers if you want. And I just sort of grabbed his arm and said, I'm going to repeat, you know, do you want to get better for good and for all? And he said, yes, absolutely. I said, then come with me. We walked into the kitchen, and I began to talk to him about my drinking. And how when I talked about it last week, when I put a bit of alcohol in me with that first drink, I want that second one more than that first, because I'm just beginning to feel a little bit of relief from that. And by the time I get that second one in me, I want that third one more than the first, and the fourth one more than the first three combined. And that feeling's always intensified, never ever satisfied. I began to talk to him about that. He says, yeah, I get that. I kept it very sad. This is exactly what I say over and over and over again. And then I began to talk to him about and it wasn't just limited to booze. You know, I wanted more of other substances. And he said, yeah, I get that. And I said, and it wasn't this. I wanted more power, more prestige, more money, more food, more sex, more love, more of anything. And he said, wait, I'm on that page. He says, this is my wife kicked me out. And I've got 5 dates lined up with 5 other women, and I wish I had 10. You know, so, I mean, this guy could easily get the idea of more and ever, you know, and more and more and more. You know, so I don't have to be traveling through, you know, pages and pages and pages of our basic text to get him to a place where he can begin to understand what happens when he takes a drink. Or, you know, and then I began to talk to him about analogy, I spoke to him about that as the way my body metabolizes alcohol is manifest as analogy. And he got that. And the phenomenon of craving is the manifestation of that analogy. And so we began to talk about the obsession of the mind. And I said, why can't I see that truth up front? Why is it I'm unable to see that I can't drink safely because I break out in an endless series of uncontrollable sprees once I put it in me? And you know, it's because I have a mind that can't see what it does to me. I only see what it does for me. And he says, I get that. And then I told him about the malady of more never satisfied, which I spoke about last week. You know, that finalizes, blocked off from the power that can broke out of me. And at that point, I began to, you know, said, you know, where are you at with God? And he says, well, I was raised with some religious background, but it hasn't been very prominent in my life. And I said, are you willing to look at that and examine, you know, that you need to have, you know, some sort of spiritual, I put it very boldly, this is a practical problem of spiritual action. You know, are you willing to, you know, pursue it on that level? And he said, what other choice do I have? Nothing else has worked. And this guy had just recently been released from the flight deck in the hospital. So it was the hopelessness and desperation of his alcoholism up front and in a timely fashion that was propelling him to be open. I don't know whether it would have worked if he'd just gotten a whole bunch of phone numbers and gone to a bunch of different meetings and told to sit back, relax, and listen. You know, and so we, I met with him the next day and we continued on. He wasn't from the area, he's since moved back, but he's, you know, I've stayed in touch and he's you know, making some progress. But it wasn't that complicated. It had nothing to do with back slapping and getting phone numbers. You know, it was given the facts, you know, and let them decide for themselves. I described how it worked in me. He could relate to it. And that's exactly what working with others talks about. But it's where I said, you know, stress the spiritual feature freely. You know, the main thing is that he'd be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and that it would live by spiritual principles. I wasn't interested in finding out what his conception of God was or what his religious practices were or anything of that sort. I really wanted to see, was he open and willing to move in that direction? That's all I needed at that point. That's all he needed at that point. And so then what's it tell me to do? On the top of 94, it tells me to outline the program of action. So I told him, the way that we would be going through it. I said, if you're willing to go through this, you're going to need to make a decision, you know, are you in or are you out? And it doesn't matter which decision you make. But if you're going to be in, then the first thing we're going to do is we're going to look at those things that have been blocking you from the power of God. And you look at, you know, who you resent, who you harm, who you're afraid. And then after that, you're going to talk to me about that. You're going to see where my defective thinking, where I talked to you about how I went through this practice program. And said, how, you know, I was able to see where all of those actions were preceded by my defective thinking, where I was selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate. And that was, you know, really the root of my defects, the root of my undoing, is my because the main problem I said centered in my mind. It was never the first drink that got me drunk. It was always my defective thinking that took me to that place where the drink made sense. We covered this last week. If your talk had been sane, again in 94, quiet and full of human understanding, you have perhaps made a friend. Maybe you have disturbed him on the question of alcoholism, and this is all to the good. I'm not here to make him feel good. This has nothing to do with feeling good, or I'm not interested in anybody's feelings. You know, I'm interested in, again, the facts. Are you, you know, do you want to get better for good and for all? Are you willing to look at what the problem is? And are you willing to move toward a solution? It's my job to disturb you on the subject of alcoholism, or the newcomer on the subject of alcoholism. And, you know, for me to, you know, be able to do that, to be armed with the facts so that I can do that one-on-one rapidly and quickly. He did have some objections, and I need to sit and listen to those objections. And then overcome them. Really, by asking questions, mostly. You know, it says your candidate may give reasons why he need not follow all the program. He may rebel at the thought of a drastic house cleaning, which requires discussion with other people. It wasn't so much, this gentleman wasn't so much disturbed then, but he says, yeah, I don't really hate that many people, or, you know, because I can see a lot of this is my own fault. Yeah, I hear that an awful lot. And then people begin to, you know, when they begin to write it down, a lot of names oftentimes show up. He was fully, he says, yeah, my drinking has laid a path of wreckage, so I know I've harmed a whole bunch of people. So, I mean, you know, beaten down, he was even at that point of complete beatenness, even and hopelessness, he was able to see and look back at the destruction that he had made and was willing to do something about it. And again, does this happen all the time? It happens infrequently in my experience, and unfortunately, I think a lot of it is because we don't emphasize the need for speed in taking someone through these spiritual principles rapidly, because we can get very comfortable sitting in meetings and drinking coffee and hanging out and counting days and all of these other things that are really distractions from our principal aim. 95 gives me some cautions. You know, not to push too hard. Quite honestly, if he's not interested in your solution, if he expects you to only act as a banker or a nurse for a speech, you may drop him until he changes his mind. You know, I can't convince anybody that they need this solution. That's what alcoholism does. That's what suffering does. That's what consequences does. You know, I'm here not to empathize with that, but to stand here and offering a handout and a solution to those problems. If he thinks he can do the job in some other way, he prefers some spiritual approach and encourage him to his own conscience. We have no monopoly on God. Earlier on in the book it says, upon therapy for the alcoholic, we surely have no monopoly. You know, again, we merely have an approach that has worked with us. Don't we have much in common, and let's be friends. And then on 96, you know, so this is all in the first visit. I've talked to him about the allergy of the body, the obsession of the mind, the malady of spirit. I've talked to him about our, you know, lack of power. I have no power, choice, or control over the substance and over my thinking mind. I cannot manage my own life. I'm out. I'm un, I need to be out of the management game. And if I have no power, then power is going to be my solution. And if power is my solution, it has to be a power greater than ourselves collectively. And am I willing to move toward that? Can I get the new prospect to be willing to move toward that? I don't care what they believe. I just want them to be willing to move toward this. And I explained to them that whatever you believe is probably going to orphan and change in some other direction once you go through this process. The process of these steps is to, one of the results of this going through this practical program of action is that it allows me to develop a relationship with this power. And so I come to a better understanding of my relationship with power. I still don't understand God. I have never will and don't try to. But I know that I can have a relationship with this power. And that's all I ask of them, to be open to that possibility. And that they will experience this as they go through this. Whether they experience it rapidly or on a gradual basis, doesn't matter. When God shows up, God shows up. And then that's enough for the first visit. The second, and then on page 96, it says very clearly, suppose you are now making your second visit to this man. He has read this volume and says he's prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. This never happens, but with that gentleman I was talking to, I actually met him 2 days later, and he said, I've already read the first 164 pages, and I'm working on the stories in the back. I was like,
you're weird.
Nobody ever does that. But even if, and in cases where the newcomer hasn't, I'll start off easily. I will always point them to the doctor's opinion and tell them the necessity for reading that. And then when I ask them, I said, do you understand what they're talking about? Can you talk to me about it? And more often than not, they generally don't quite get some of it. They may get some of the points. And so that gives me an idea of where to start working with them. But here, it says, on my second visit, he's read the volume and is prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. He's made his decision, his third step decision, am I in or am I out? If he's in, then having had the experience myself, I can give him much practical advice. So we're ready to go. And generally at that point, I would take him back to the doctor's opinion. And as I said last week, I don't go through this paragraph by paragraph, page by page, or line by line. I hit and jump. I talk about after the end of Sokor's first letter, in that first paragraph afterward, where it talks about the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. And it did not satisfy that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life and on full flight from reality or outright mental defective. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we were sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. I need to speak to him about, and this comes right from Sokor's advice to Bill Wilson when he was out there at Calvary Church and trying to sell all the drunks on a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening. And he was having absolutely no luck, and so forth told him, listen, you've got to hammer the hopelessness of the illness of the body and the hopelessness of the sickened mind. And so this is where Silkworth started off, and this is where I start off. I speak about the allergy of the body. And as I've mentioned many times, I put it in me, I treat the allergy, I'm not done with alcohol until alcohol is done with me. And if they can identify with that, I ask them to be able to explain it back to me. Again, because my purpose is primarily to have them be able to rapidly and quickly show someone else how to take someone through this book. And so I want to make sure that they understand it as best they can in terms of their own drinking, and that they have enough understanding of it that they can repeat it back to someone else. That's why I repeat an awful lot of things over and over and over again. The alms in the body. You've heard me say, I put the first one in me, I want the second one in, the third, and on and on and on. I repeat that over and over again. And when they start repeating it back to me, I know I'm making progress because they're listening. And they're hopefully absorbing and matching my experience and their experience with the information in this book. And if they can do that, then I turn over the page to Roman numeral 28 in the fourth edition. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action, the effect of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of analogy. The phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Again, a simple question that I always ask the newcomer, the prospect. Have you ever drunk more than you intended? When I was asked that question, I was like, well, simple, when didn't you drink more than you intended? And, because this allergic type can never use alcohol safely in any form whatsoever. When they talk about the craving in this book, it's always about the physical allergy. It's impossible for me to crave alcohol after 72 hours after it's left my body. Then we're talking about an obsession. And then I bring their attention down to the bottom of that page. But it's important that they know that there is a physical element to this thing called alcoholism. And then it tells me down on the bottom of the page that I drink essentially because I like the effects produced by alcohol, what it does for me. I don't see what it does to me, but I love what it does for me. This sensation is so elusive that while I admit it's injurious, I cannot after a time, harmful, I cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To me, the alcoholic life is the only normal one. To me, once I got it in me, that's when I began to feel like a normal human being, what I thought a normal human being was supposed to feel like. That's when I could begin to, my operating system kicked in. But then that next line describes my state of existence, the state of my mind, before I pick up the drink, before I put it in. I am restless, I'm irritable, and I'm discontented. And or I'm filled with guilt, shame, fear, and remorse from the things I do in my screens. And again, unless I can again experience that sense of ease and comfort, that sense of, yes, it's all going to be okay. That sense of normalcy that comes with a couple. James said, I see others and I use this as my rationalization. Hey, other people are drinking, I'm in control at this time. And after I've succumbed to that desire and I put it in me and I trigger the phenomenon of craving and I have to have more and I go on my spree, and then I emerge from that spree remorseful and a firm resolution not to drink again. And this is repeated over and over and over and over and over. And unless I can experience that entire psychic change, there's very little hope of my recovery. So I talk to them, is that your experience? And it's your experience is that once you put it, that you don't see the truth about the phenomenon of craving before you drink. I never did. And even if I did, I always had some rationalization that would twist it and turn it around so that this time it's going to be different. I never picked up a drink of alcohol on the truth. I always picked up a drink of alcohol on the lie. The lie that somehow, some way, this is going to be different this time. The most insane thing I ever did, I did from a standpoint of absolute sobriety, which was to pick up the drink again. That's where that's the insanity of the first drink. The insanity is that I'm completely sober. I've had an experience that I can't bring into my consciousness with sufficient force, and I put it in. No one else, no one other than an alcoholic does that. I take them to Bill's story. By this point, I have asked them to read the doctor's opinion. I've asked them probably to read the first 8 pages at least of Bill's story and to try to identify with it. And if they have, I ask them what parts they can identify with. And some people relate to it rather easily and quickly, and some people have a difficult time relating to Bill's story. And depending upon their relationship to it, I'll either, if they're having a difficult time pointing out to it, I begin to, I'll start right at the beginning and talk to them about how he discovers liquor innocently enough, you know, in pre-war parties, you know, up in upstate New York, and yet he goes to England and, you know, gripped in fear, he ends up at Winchester Cathedral, having his first spiritual experience because he needed and wanted God and had a relationship or a spiritual experience in the cathedral, and then he went outside and had his famous run-in with the gravestone of Thomas Stetcher, and who, you know, died of drinking beer, and yet an ominous warning which Bill failed to heed. But then, can I relate to this? You know, I fancied myself a leader. Already Bill is living in his head and fantasizing about, you know, things that may or may not necessarily be true. And then he returns home. And of course, it was establishing himself both, you know, trying first at law and then in business, you know, liquor keeps getting in the way. And so I ask him, well, you know, where's liquor gotten in the way with you? So can I begin to relate to him with that? Out of the alloy of drink and speculation, you know, Bill begins to develop the weapon that would become the boomerang and would one day, you know, take him out. You know, and you know, Bill was not just a, you know, an alcoholic, but also an adrenaline junkie. You know, running on the thrill of making money and all of that. And, you know, can I get a newcomer to see where other ways that they've been living have joined in to, you know, fuel the fire. Over on page 5, you know, I take, for the next few, you know, years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. My judgment and ideas were followed by many of the tune of paper millions. The boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important, exhilarating part of my life. Now, I don't care, you know, whether somebody related to, you know, working on the street or anything like that, but was drink taking an exhilarating and an important part of my life? It was taking all of my life. And, you know, and depending upon the individual and their experience, I can point that out to them. Do they make a host of fair weather friends? All of these things that, you know, are have little to do. I don't need to relate to Bill as a Wall Street hanger-on or a speculator or anything like that. And you know, a man in the 30s, what I need to do is get them to relate to the way that Bill drank, the way Bill thought about drinking, the way Bill reacted once he began, you know, drinking, and why he couldn't stop. It talks about how with the market crashing on Black Friday in 29, and people are all in a tither and jumping from the streets to find walls of five finance. And what does Bill do? His solution is to go back to the bar. I get it. You know, there's my solution. You know, it's like, can I get someone on the same page with that? Drinking catches up with me again. You know, and I became an unwelcome hanger-on. I can relate to that. Can I get a newcomer to relate to that? Mm-hmm. And then, what happens? Gradually, things get worse. And by this point, I've had some understanding of what's going on with the newcomer and where things have gotten bad with him. And you know, with Bill, okay, the house is taken over, the mortgage, you know, by the mortgage. He loses the house, the mother-in-law dies, you know, both his wife, you know, Lois, and his father-in-law, you know, get ill. I mean, things just happen rapidly and quickly with us. It doesn't. I fell off a lot of cliffs, not just, you know, gradual declines. But so all of this goes wrong, and what does Bill do? He renews his resolve. Willpower. Where did willpower work in my life? And I give some examples to the newcomer. And, you know, has willpower ever worked in your life? How long did it work? Because oftentimes, oh yeah, willpower worked. Well, did it work for good and for all? how long did it work? You know, if my purpose in taking them through this is to, if they still have an objection, like, yeah, willpower worked. Sometimes I was able to, you know, just say no. Okay, but the operative word here is sometimes. What about the other times? We've got to be able to pull that rug out from underneath them. Remorse, horror, and hopelessness for the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. Am I the only one who's ever, you know, experienced writhing nerves? That always had the black cloud over his head? You know, that there was always something that was going to go wrong. And then where does that take Bill? To a place where he's drinking only for oblivion. I talked to him this week about how that's, you know, ultimately that's the place that took me to where I'm living in the woods, and I drink only for oblivion, immediately after cursing God. Bill's body and mind and body endured this for 2 more years. I endured that same situation for many, many years as well. And then finally, willpower doesn't work. Self-knowledge hasn't worked. You know, by this time, Bill has gotten into Towns Hospital. He's found out about the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. And yet still, you know, he thinks that self-knowledge is going to work. And if the newcomer has gone through any sort of rehab or therapeutic program, you know, I ask him, how well does that work? Why are you, you know, coming back from a relapse if you've gone to enough rehabs? You know, self-knowledge avails me nothing. And can I get him to relate to that? And bring him to that point where no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I was overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And if alcohol is my master, then I do its bidding, and I'm not done with alcohol until alcohol is done with me. I am its slave. Bill knew his truth when he was out there. I know my truth when I'm out there. I don't need the fellowship. I don't need the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous to teach me or tell me what my truth is. I need you to explain to me why that's my truth. And I need you to show me the solution and how to get achieve that solution. But the alcoholism is what takes me to that hopeless, you know, loneliness and despair. And then I'll generally move on more toward layers of solution. Because I want to keep them focused on the hopelessness of their condition in my first meeting with them. Where it says on 24, the absolute truth, that most alcoholics, me, the alcoholic, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. My willpower becomes practically non-existent. I am unable, at certain times, to bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the pain, the suffering, and humiliation of a day, a week, or a month ago. I am without defense against the first drink. And sometimes I can do that, and that tricks me. And it makes me believe once again that, hey, this time I can get away with it. But at certain times I can't. I'm doomed. You know, certain consequences that follow taking a glass of, you know, of human beer don't crowd into my mind and deter me. There's a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps me from putting my hand on a hot stove. You know. That seems to make sense. You know, I can read that. Well, why would I put my hand on a hot stove? You know, and you would think that I would be able to learn from my alcoholic experience, but I don't. You know, I have a good friend of mine, Kim, who is an average type of social drinker. And when I was first going through this, and I, you know, and she was sort of the person I could bounce things off of in terms of what a normal drink was like. And I said, you know, what happens when you take a drink of alcohol? And she said, well, I get a slightly tipsy beginning of a normal feeling. And what happens when you take two? And she said, well, I pretty much just want to go to sleep. And I said, what happens when you take more than two? And she says, I don't. And I said, what do you mean? She said, don't you remember, you know, 10 years ago when we went to that party, and it was outside, it was hot, and they had a blender going, and I drank a whole bunch of margaritas and frozen things, and I ended up throwing up in the bushes, and I woke up the next morning with a hangover, an end-all hangover, and I said, I never forgot that, and I never drank like that again. Locked up, get released, and before you know it, I'm heading to the bar, playing my defense, my legal defense, strategy. And because I can't, there's no complete failure of a kind of defense that keeps me from putting my hot stove. I can't remember from moment to moment that I can't drink safely. Those peeps, those disgusting little yellow marshmallowy things that come out of Easter. Actually, they probably have them for all. They have them for all the holidays now. Little pumpkins and all that. Well, when I was like, I don't know, 4 or 5 years old, I went with my mother to the store, and she bought a couple packages of those things. And when we got home, she gave me one of them, and then she went about doing her housekeeping or cleaning or whatnot, and I finished that peep, and it tasted so good that I had a second peep. And then I had a third, and I went through that first package, and I managed to open up the second package, and before you know it, I'm re-peeping all those peeps all over the floor. And now it's been well over half a century, and I have never had a desire to go to the store, buy a couple packages of peeps, and eat them to excess. I can consistently see the truth about peeps. But I could never bring to my consciousness with sufficient force the list of loss that are associated with alcoholism is ridiculous, and yet it doesn't matter. But peeps, I'm fine with them. When this sort of thinking is fully established as an individual with alcoholic tendencies, I have probably placed myself beyond human aid. Again, this is what I want to emphasize first and foremost to the prospect, is that you are beyond human aid, that we are not a self-help society, we are a mutual aid society. I can walk side by side with you and show you what I have done and encourage you to do what we do, but doing it on my own resources alone is insufficient. Doing it with just the resources of human aid within the fellowship, or just doing it with other human aid of any sort, was insufficient for me to recover. I have to have a power greater than myself. What's it saying? But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. Somebody want to stop it or not? And so it tells me, again, in this chapter, there is a solution. It gives us the example of Roland Hazard, and I'll talk more about that, and Fitzmaier and all of that. But by the time I get to 28, and when I talk about, I in turn sought the same escape with all the desperation of a drowning man. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has proven to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given to you, your preferred design for living that really works. This is where I begin to sell the hope. I've taken them to the place where you're screwed. You're absolutely hopeless. Step one doesn't tell me that I can't drink. Step one tells me that I'm doomed to repeat. That I'm absolutely going to drink again. And that I cannot see the truth, and I can't manage my way out of that. I can't think my way out of it. I can't resolve my way out of it. I can't be afraid enough to keep myself sober. Nothing is going to work on my own human aid or even the assistance of other humans. I have to have God's help. But when I adopt that, when I give up completely, then I'm given a new way of life. And it takes me to that, again, that place of hope. Because by this point I'm about to describe to him each individual in my personal story, describes in my own language and from my own point of view the way I established my relationship with God. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages, and we will believe that it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems to them that we will be persuaded to say, "Yep, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing." And again, chapter 3 begins to take me to a place where it's going to talk specifically about my mind. And I can talk to the newcomer about my mind and where it will always take me back to a place of, for lack of a better term, relapse. And it starts off, again, with more information. Most of us have been unwilling to admit I'm a real alcoholic. I skipped over it, but I talked to him about page 21, you know, the real alcoholic, and as opposed to this, the average temperate social drinker. Unable to, because an average temperate social drinker can take it or leave it alone. I asked the newcomer, can you take it or leave it alone? And what about the hard drinker? The hard drinker who, you know, given sufficient reason, can stop and moderate. And then me, I'm unable to stop, moderate, or control in any way, shape, or form. I'm the real alcoholic. I don't like to think I'm bodily and mentally different, bodily because of the allergy of the body, mentally because of the obsession of the mind. Therefore, it's not surprising that my drinking career was characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that I could drink like other people. The idea, the thought in my head, the idea that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. And when I, you know, pulled up to those gates, I was willing to pay the toll. Didn't matter. Somehow, I'm going to control and enjoy. There's the lie. There's the delusion. There's the falsehood. I could sometimes control it, but I was certainly not enjoying it. When I was enjoying it, there was no control. And even if I had to control it, I was only waiting to the point where I no longer had to control it. And by then, all bets were off once the time was up and I had to, you know, get going and get business done. The delusion, the lie that I'm like other people, or presently maybe, had to be smashed. I've lost the ability to control my drinking. I never recover control. I oftentimes think I'm regaining control. Followed by still less control, which takes me to a point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. The price is paid. I'm in the grip of a progressive illness over any considerable period. I've gotten worse, never better. To the newcomer, is that your experience? Have things gotten better for you, or have they gotten worse? And then we go through the examples. Mr. Bone Dry, separated for a period of time. And he uses willpower and fails miserably. And then we get to Jim, where it suddenly happens. Well, suddenly, you know. Actually, with Mr. Bone Dry. Commencing on page 33. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, I'm in short time as bad as ever. If I'm planning to stop drinking, I like it. How successful was I ever when I was planning to stop drinking? I never stopped drinking. I was separated from the substance. God separated me from alcoholism. I never successfully could quit on my own. That's just another lie that I tell myself. But even if I think that I can stop at some point, there must be no reservation of any kind or any lurking notion. A reservation is nothing other than a plan for the future. When I go on vacation, I make a reservation in a hotel or a dinner, a plan for my future. There can't be any lurking notion that somehow, some way, I'm going to be immune from alcohol. Once I'm armed with the facts and I can convince the newcomer that you know, they're hopeless because of the allergy of the body and the mind, they can't see that truth, I want to, again, pull that rug out of any lurking notions that they might have. And so then, Jim. Jim's a wonderful guy. We told him what we knew about alcoholism. We gave him the information on step one. And the answers we had found. We'll see that step two is an answer. It's what, you know, power is my solution. Step three, he made a beginning. Things get back together. However, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. How do I enlarge my spiritual life? By the actions that I take in steps 4 through 12. All this is on page 35. And what happens? He gets drunk again half a dozen times. And on each of these occasions, we worked with him. Time after time after time. There's no time limit on how long I'm going to work with a newcomer. I don't tell him not to drink. I don't have that power not to drink. I expect him to drink. I expect a newcomer to relapse or to continue drinking. You know? Until they've gone through some of this process and seen begin to see some results, their solution is still going to be right in front of them at the liquor store or at the bar. For me to tell someone not to drink is ridiculous. That's why I want to take them through this rapidly and quickly while they are sober or when they sober up again. They work with them time after six times, half a dozen times, and we continue to work with them. Because he agreed he was a real alcoholic and in serious trouble, serious condition. As long as there's willingness, I will work with him. I got a text from a guy who has stopped taking phone calls because he keeps drinking. And he recently said, "I'm not worthy to take your phone calls anymore." I was like, "Oh, so now you're feeling sorry for yourself." So I went over and knocked on his door. And he said, "What are you doing here? I told you I'm not worthy." He's like, "Oh, stop it." You know, I just laugh at him. It's like, who said you're not worthy? Do you want to stop? Do you want to try again? Well, yeah. Okay, so we do it again. It's not on my schedule. I don't have a schedule for it. I just keep showing up. That's my job. So what happens with Jim? Suddenly happens with Jim. You know? He failed to enlarge his spiritual life. A thought comes to mind, and he's off to the races. He's full of resentment because he's not working. He's working in a place that he used to own. Blah 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 blah. A thought crossed my mind that if I could somehow, some way, this experiment went so well. Average temperate social drinkers don't have experiments about controlling their booze. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call it plain insanity. How can a lack of proportion and the ability to think straight be anything else? You know? There's always that curious mental phenomenon parallel with my sound reasoning. I know I can't. I can't drink. Bang, bang, boom, right on down the tracks until, screw it, I'm going to have a drink. That insanely trivial excuse always pops up. My sound reasoning failed and the insane idea won out. Why? Because I have no defense against the first drink. I have no relationship with power. That's again, and every relapse or every fall back into the bottle is another blessing for the drunk to say, I just show up and say, this is why you need power. You know, how many more bottles is it going to take you to convince you? Because that's what's going to convince them, not me. I can help them and convince them that they need to do this work, that they need to engage in these actions. But the bottle's a much bigger motivator than my words. What's it say in the bottom of 38? There's the judgment game again. My bottom might be lower than someone's, and someone else's bottom might be higher. We have not gone to the extremes you fellows did, nor are we likely, for we understand myself so well that while you have, what you have told us, now that you've told us such things, it won't happen again. We have not lost everything in life through drinking, and we certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. That may be true for certain non-alcoholic people, who, though drinking foolishly and heavily, at the present time, are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies are not as damaged as mine. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is the point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize, to smash home upon the alcoholic leader, as it has been revealed to us in our bitter experience. Let us take another illustration, and then there's Fred. Fred, you know, unlike Jim, who is resentful, Fred has a business deal that goes well. Everything's going great with Fred. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. If you're familiar with Bill's talking about Fred as the example. He had some experience with this. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves. He made up his mind. He used his willpower and reserve to quit drinking. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic. He wouldn't concede step one, much less accept the spiritual remedy for his problem, or step two. So he ends up just not drinking, using his willpower as best he can, using the knowledge that he's gained as best he can, and then the perfect day happens. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. He wasn't hungry, angry, lonely, tired. There were no triggers of any sort, nothing of any nature like that. And yet he goes, and the thought came to mind about having a couple of cocktails. Not one, but a couple. And he goes and he ends up on another endless spree. And he learns. Doesn't matter. Self-knowledge availed me nothing, just like Bill, just like Fred. Willpower availed me nothing, just like Jim, just like Bill. Fear doesn't work, just like Mr. Bone Dry, just like me, just like Bill. Can I get the prospect to be on these same pages with me? Because then it takes me to that place where, as the doctor says on page 43, as to the two of you men whose stories I have heard, there is no doubt in my mind that you are 100% hopeless apart from divine help. Had you offered yourself as patients, I would not have taken you. People like me are just too darn heartbreaking. For most cases, there's virtually no other solution other than a spiritual one. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. I think we'll stop it right there. And next week we will cover how I go through steps two and three again. In about an hour, hour and a half maybe at best, and then I'll start giving them the instructions for four. So we'll open it up to comments and questions. Thank you.